Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of the show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, let's look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. According to the Bureau of Economic Analysis, personal income decreased 1.3% or $159.8 billion in June, and disposable personal income decreased $143.8 billion or 1.3% in June in the United States. In another area, the U.S. Post Office considers closing 1,000 branches. The U.S. Postal Service announces it's considering closing 1,000 post offices around the country to try to help offset its massive budget deficit, according to NBC's Lisa Myers. A pillar of U.S. communities since the nation's founding, the post office is facing the prospect of closings or consolidation of services at hundreds of locations amid a sharp decline in business due to email. The Postal Service may register a loss of nearly $7 billion this fiscal year in spite of a 2-cent increase in the price of stamps in May, cuts in staff, and removal of collection boxes. The post office officials sent a list of nearly 700 potential candidates for closing or consolidation to the Independent Postal Regulatory Commission for review. More may be added, but the current list of candidates can be viewed at the Commission's website. Some of the offices could be closed, while others could have some of their functions consolidated with other offices. For example, in some cases, preparing mail for delivery may be shifted from Office A to nearby Office B, but the first office might still offer such services as selling stamps and mailing parcels and letters. In other cases, one of the offices might be closed. Postal Vice President Jordan Small told a congressional subcommittee that local managers will study activities of approximately 32,000 stations and branches across the country and consider factors such as customer access, service standards, cost savings, impact on employees, environmental impact, real estate values, and long-term postal service needs. No changes are expected before the end of the current fiscal year on September 30th. There are 32,741 post offices. Small stated that we anticipate that out of these stations and branches, under 1,000 offices could be considered as viable candidates to study further. In addition to the switch of business to the internet, the recession has hurt the post office by reducing advertising mail. Last year's high gas prices also siphoned millions of dollars from its coffers. Just last week, the Government Accountability Office added the Postal Service to its list of troubled agencies, saying serious and significant structural financial challenges face the agency. Every major postal policy, from employee pay to days of delivery to the closing of postal facilities, must be on the table. Without major change, the day will soon come when the Postal Service will be unable to pay its bills, according to the GAO. Congress is considering a bill to change the way the Post Office funds its retiree health benefits over the next 2 years that could save it $2 billion annually. The Post Office also filed a petition with the Independent Postal Regulatory Commission, indicating that managers are looking at closing many post offices to save money. In addition, Postmaster General John Potter has asked Congress for permission to reduce mail deliveries from 6 days a week to 5. Last year, mail volume fell by 9.5 billion pieces to a total of 203 billion pieces. It is expected to fall by 28 billion pieces this year to a total of 175 billion pieces of mail. Moving on to mortgage issues, the biggest lenders among the worst performers in Obama mortgage plans, according to Dawn Kopecky. Some of the largest U.S. mortgage servicers may rank among the worst performers in modifying loans when the U.S. Treasury reveals how much assistance banks have offered to struggling homeowners. The biggest servicers certainly have the biggest ships to turn, according to Seth Wheeler, a Deputy Assistant Treasury Secretary for Federal Finance. He said that some of the strongest performers are smaller servicers, but it's not a uniform correlation. Bank of America Corp., Citigroup Inc., J.P. Morgan Chase and Company, and Wells Fargo and Company, four of the largest U.S. mortgage servicers, are likely to show the poorest levels of homeowner assistance among the 31 companies participating in President Barack Obama's $75 billion loan modification program, according to David Sisko, the head of default management services for Deloitte and Touche LLP in Charlotte, North Carolina. A majority of them have an inability to handle the demand, an inability to process the waterfall calculations, and a high volume of first-look denials, Sisko said. The Making Home Affordable Loan Modification Program was crafted this year to help as many as 4 million borrowers save their homes. The Obama administration said last month that more than 200,000 trial loan modifications have begun, and it's setting a goal of starting at least 500,000 by November 1st. Wheeler wouldn't discuss specific data or names in the report. According to Lawrence Summers, director of the National Economic Council, our intention, once this data has been collected and processed, is for there to be transparency so that people can see it in a numerical way, who's been good and what performance has been. Bank of America modified 150,000 loans through other programs in the first half as we ramped up to make Obama's Making Home Affordable program operational, said Dan Fram, a spokesman for the Charlotte, North Carolina-based company. Just as you can't judge a student's performance for the semester by looking at their grade for one class, Making Home Affordable is one component of a comprehensive program Bank of America has placed to support homeowners, Fram said. Loan servicers send out bills, collect debts, and keep records for mortgage lenders. A group of servicers met with Obama administration's officials on July 28th and pledged to set up the pace of loan modifications to keep more homeowners from sliding into foreclosure, according to the Treasury. J.P. Morgan Chase is happy with this program so far, said Christine Holivas, a spokeswoman for the New York-based company. That always has to be tempered with the fact that the demand is great. We know that we have more to do, Holivas said. We believe we've made significant progress. We've ramped up, we've hired people, we've added office space, we've invested in technology. Looking at the TARP money, J.P. Morgan Chase said June 30th that it approved 87,100 loans for modification under the administration's plan since April 6th. A spokeswoman for San Francisco-based Wells Fargo, Deborah Blum, declined to discuss the Treasury report. Mark Rogers, a spokesman for New York-based Citigroup, also wouldn't comment. Senate Banking Committee Chairman Christopher Dodd, a Connecticut Democrat, assailed the administration at a hearing last month for the sluggish results from anti-foreclosure programs, while industry executives spoke of the confusion and delay from the government-set rules for the program. More than 1.5 million properties received a default or auction notice or were seized by banks in the 6 months through June, according to RealtyTrack, Inc. That's a 15% increase from a year earlier. The Making Home Affordable program requires banks that receive federal aid from the Treasury's Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, as well as mortgage finance companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, to lower the monthly payments for borrowers at imminent risk of default. Banks can lengthen repayment terms, lower interest rates to as low as 2%, and forbear outstanding principal, among other methods. Citigroup and Bank of America each received about $45 billion from TARP, while Wells Fargo took in $25 billion. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now let's move on to the second section of the show. The last couple of weeks, we've been looking at some issues when people are in serious debt trouble. I've been discussing Chapter 7 bankruptcy as one way to deal with that problem. And we'll continue with some of the things that all people who have serious debt issues should consider when dealing with their activity. Before I get started, I'd like to give a credit to Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi, who are really truly two of America's leading champions for debtors. The thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of these debt scholars, and I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. And I also highly recommend that people revisit the shows that I have produced. You can always go to www.kruufm.com into the archives under Life and Debt, and you can listen to all of the shows that we have produced in the past regarding many, many different issues on how to deal with your debt and your finances, your budget, and making your future a lot more stable and financially successful. So to start, just a simple review of some of the points from last week's show. I said that if you are in serious financial difficulty, this happens to many people. They choose to cash out a retirement plan, a 401k, an IRA, or take a substantial loan against it. This sounds like a good idea when your creditors are calling you asking for money. However, these are retirement plans, and it is basically a special fund for the future. It's not a savings account. When you take money from it, there are penalties, there are taxes that get assessed, and it really dims your future financial stability tremendously. Also, when you're looking at the potential need to file a bankruptcy, taking money out of these plans may, in most states, be treated as income during the last 6 months before you file. And this could reduce a person's potential to do a straight Chapter 7 kind of liquidation bankruptcy and push them into a Chapter 13 payback plan, even though they are, in fact, not making enough money every month to support a reasonable plan over 3 to 5 years. The way the new law was set up, it is really very detrimental to people who make a mistake like this, cash out their 401k plans, and then are being attacked by creditors at the same time, want to file bankruptcy, and yet now they're looking at a nearly impossible financial situation for themselves over months and months, either not being able to file the bankruptcy or being in a Chapter 13 bankruptcy, which they can't really afford with actual numbers. So do not cash out that retirement plan. Speak to your lawyer. Another thing that I discussed last week, and it's a very important point, and this really impacts just about everyone with creditors hounding after them, whether they are people who are considering a bankruptcy or think that they're just smart and they want to not pay certain creditors, that they do something that would delay, hinder, or defraud a creditor from collecting the debt. For example, they may have a piece of property that they quit claim deed to a relative, or other assets that they sign away, gift to someone else, all of which creates an insolvency position for them. It certainly protects the asset in their mind, but in fact, it opens a door for a type of fraud against the creditors. one has to be very careful in this kind of area with this kind of thinking. As I mentioned, we can always sell something for fair market value, if in fact it is truly fair market value. If it's to an insider, a relative, it's looked at a little bit more closely and carefully. But if the money comes in and then it gets spent on other things and the creditors don't get to it, and those other things are just normal, allowable expenses, that generally is not a problem. It doesn't create insolvency at the time of the transfer. But it is a very important general principle that we do not do anything that would delay, hinder, or defraud a creditor from collecting the debt that we owe. Another point, right when we are at the gate of filing bankruptcy, many people have used their ingenuity in making balance transfers on credit cards, which actually has worked very well over years for reducing interest rates. But if we are really close to filing a bankruptcy, we would stop making those kinds of transfers. Another point, which is very common, is that we are dealing with creditors who are hounding us, trying to collect a debt, and then we make some verbal promise that we intend to pay it, or we're going to do this kind of action in the near future regarding that debt, which is to the creditor's benefit, etc. Again, if you are planning to file bankruptcy, you do not tell your creditors that you intend to pay them. In fact, what you do is you retain an attorney and you tell your creditor to call your legal representative. Much better and more honest statement to the creditor. A point that I raised last week is that people often receive huge amounts of tax refunds historically, year after year after year, with a household of 3, 4, 5, 6 people. We're seeing tax refunds of $5,000, $6,000, $7,000. Sometimes that is related to earned income credit, but oftentimes it's just that people are setting up their tax withholding in such a way that they will get a larger lump sum later on. That sounds like a prudent and wise way to use the federal government as a savings account, but when you think about it, you're not getting any interest on that money. You don't have it available to you when you might need it during the course of a year. And it also creates some problems for people who need to file bankruptcy in that this money can be exposed to your unsecured creditors depending on the time of filing the bankruptcy and also the type of bankruptcy you're filing. Chapter 7, for example, if you filed your bankruptcy before you receive that money, the trustee may claim that money or a substantial portion of it for your unsecured creditors. And if you are in a Chapter 13 repayment plans kind of bankruptcy, then you've set a historical precedent for having large tax refunds. And it's not easy to go in once that plan is filed for you to then change your W-4 setup so you're receiving less money in your refund. The problem with that is, in fact, that tax refund check does in states like Iowa become part of your Chapter 13 payment. So over 3 to 5 years, one is actually losing all that money to the creditors. Whereas if one was normally paying their taxes during the year so that the withholding was not going to give them a huge refund, then the creditors don't have anything to go after in terms of the bankruptcy status that one finds oneself in. But this is something that I see regularly among middle and lower class people. There is just way too much refund coming every year. So you need to discuss that with your attorney. Another thing, if one needs to file bankruptcy, is the inheritance situation. If one has just received an inheritance, then you certainly need to speak with your attorney about that, and the timing of filing that bankruptcy may be changed. And also, if one is filing bankruptcy and then within 6 months receives an inheritance, that money is generally going to come back into the bankruptcy estate for your unsecured creditors. So you have to look at your personal family situation to see if that is something which is imminent. An inheritance is coming soon. And if it seems to be, then one may need to wait to file the bankruptcy. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Another important point regarding bankruptcy filing is purchasing a home, the timing of that. One may feel that they want to purchase a home, they have a little money for the down payment, and frankly, very little left to pay unsecured debt that has been building up, but they just want to protect themselves and have a homestead, which they have not had. It is a very important general rule that we do not purchase anything very large, a home, a car, a platinum TV, huge computer purchase, without consulting an attorney, if in fact we are still looking at insolvency in the very near future. In the home situation, pre-acquisition debt can go after the equity, even though in a state like Iowa, the house's equity for a homestead is normally exempt in an unlimited amount. The debt has to come after one has created that homestead. So that's not going to protect somebody. And then on the other hand, going out and spending money on luxury items, which are expensive and not necessary for subsistence and bare necessity, can become an issue if then one instantaneously becomes insolvent and did not think about the purchase in relationship to one's finances, and then the need for bankruptcy crops up very quickly. It's not that these things become insurmountable. It's something that often just changes the timing of dealing with bankruptcy. And what we experience is that people start thinking about the challenges of their financial dilemma when the creditors start hounding them, when there's a lawsuit, and then it's not just the lawsuit, it's the garnishment that follows after the lawsuit, the levies, the attachments, the bank accounts getting garnished, the wages that people make getting garnished, and then they're in a real challenge circumstance because 25% or more of their paycheck is going off to try to satisfy a judgment rather than dealing with their needs and the cost of doing a bankruptcy. So one should be very careful about making huge purchases which are going to throw one into an insolvency kind of circumstance. Another point that I've been discussing is the idea of refinancing one's house, taking out a second mortgage, using the equity to pay off some debt, particularly unsecured debt, or for purchases such as vacations or other expensive items. Whatever it may be, the idea that the second mortgage is using a quote-unquote savings kind of account that you have accumulated over the years. Professor Warren and her daughter and I all take the very same strong position that this is a huge mistake for most people. We don't look at the house as a savings account or as something that's going to bail us out financially from other kinds of debt circumstances. It's the place where we live. It's our homestead. And we should not jeopardize that status with taking liens against it, particularly with the way the mortgage industry has worked with adjustable rate mortgages and all of these points and fees and option kinds of loans, which frankly balloon into a huge problem for most people. And many of the foreclosures that we see in the media news are related to not first mortgages, but second mortgages or refinancing mortgages. In my experience, this is one of the conditions that puts a lot of people who could be in a Chapter 7 into a Chapter 13 to try to save their home, paying off the arrearages that they have accumulated over time, people who can't really afford to be in Chapter 13, but because it is their homestead, which they and their family have lived in for a long time and are straining to keep and maintain, they go into a Chapter 13 to try to make the payments on the arrearages. And of course, they have to be up to date on the current payments too. So it's not an easy circumstance. And the truth of the matter is that most people do ultimately lose their homes when they are falling behind on these second kinds of refinancing mortgages. So it is not a kind of thing that you want to do to help yourself to get out of financial trouble. And it's important to recognize that if one does wind up in the circumstances in which you need to file a bankruptcy, you need to tell your attorney about all of your assets. You can't hide any assets, and you need to tell your attorney about all of your debts. As I mentioned earlier, you can't start transferring things. You can't start putting your money into your kids' bank accounts, for example. Or you cannot omit, or what some people consider saving, a credit card for after your bankruptcy by not placing that into the disclosure that you are requested. It turns out that with the public access computer technology, major credit card companies find out about one's bankruptcy anyway, and even though you owe that company no money on that card, they will still cancel the card. Everything has to be disclosed. Assets, creditors, income, transfers, all these things are really important concepts when looking at one's finances. It's also important to recognize that many people have loans with family members. We call them insiders sometimes, partners, very close, intimate friends. And these are debts that would also need to be disclosed in a bankruptcy. And more importantly, if you've been paying people back who are insiders, the trustee wants to know what you paid them back over the last 12 months before you filed the bankruptcy. And in some cases, when that is a meaningful amount of money, the trustee can go after that repayment as a preference to an insider and would come back into the bankruptcy estate to be spread out to all the unsecured creditors, not just a family member or an insider. It's often the case when people start getting into trouble financially, when one is on a slippery slope and feeling the huge amount of burden from the debt while one is facing insolvency, to pay those creditors who are close to us, insiders, first. That feels like a natural thing to do, but this is something that the law says is unfair. It's an unfair preference, and the look-back period is 1 year. Another peculiar point when people are having huge financial problems is they start writing checks against a bank account where the balance doesn't cover the checks. It's actually very surprising how frequently people do this. This, of course, is not a good idea at all. It is something that needs to be avoided. And in most states, this does have criminal implications and serious ramifications. I think it's often the result of the real talent that some creditors have in collecting debt and really imposing a huge emotional strain on people, harassing them, and just getting them to send a check. It also is very surprising that people often respond by sending a check that is going to bounce. So it may put that creditor off for a couple of weeks, but it's not going to be something that is a benefit to anybody. That seems obvious, and yet it happens very frequently. So we do not write bad checks. We will continue with more points next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt education.